Case number 21-3128, United States of America versus Joan L. Rice. Oral argument is not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Ms. Malone for the appellant.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Vanessa Malone, and I represent Joan L. Rice in this appeal. I would request 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
Thank you. At the base of this appeal is the fact that Joan L. Rice was sentenced to 15 years of incarceration as an armed career criminal in August of 2016. In August of 2016, Mr. Rice, at his sentencing, challenged the fact that he was an armed career criminal based upon his three prior Ohio Revised Code, Section 291102A3, robberies. Mr. Rice was unsuccessful, and at the sentencing, the district court stated that this court's decision, unpublished decision, in United States versus Manser applied, notwithstanding the fact that Johnson versus United States was decided in 2015, which upended the residual clause of the ACCA.
Ms. Malone, now, could I interrupt you to ask a question to sort of frame your arguments, at least for my purposes? Are you asking us to find that this change in construction is an extraordinary and compelling circumstance, or rather to remand it so the judge can determine whether it is or is not in his judgment?
I would ask this court to find that the district court erred in determining that the 15-year sentence imposed was not an exceptional or compelling circumstance, based upon the fact that the 15-year sentence no longer applies.
I understand that, but that doesn't answer the question. Are you asking us to answer whether it is extraordinary, compelling, or to send it back for the judge to revisit whether it is extraordinary and compelling?
I would frame my answer and state that the district court should be able to revisit the extraordinary and compelling circumstances.
So in other words, he has the discretion to do that. That's what you're saying.
Correct. Okay, the district court has discretion.
Thank you.
Correct. And it was an abuse of discretion. I argue herein that the district court determined that a 15-year sentence, even though it no longer applies, was not an exceptional or compelling circumstance based upon the fact that Mr. Rice's statutory maximum is now 10 years as opposed to 15.
Are you saying the district court felt it had no discretion? Is that your position? I mean, is that what you think the district court said?
I believe the district court, in its order, and in these compassionate release hearings, there is no transcript or no argument or anything. These are all decided on the paper. So all I can go on is what the district court placed in its order. And in its order, it stated that the 15-year sentence was in place because Mr. Rice did not present any exceptional or compelling circumstances sufficient
But is that really the case? I thought the district judge thought that he was bound by a non-retroactive legislative provision, and that's an error. Well, that's why I'm trying to figure out what it is you really want us to do here.
The district court did state, Your Honor, that it says that these changes are not retroactive. And that provides the second basis for the argument today, because Mr. Rice never requested any retroactive application.
Malone, we got to take it sort of step at a time here.
I'm sorry.
If the district judge made a mistake, we need to figure out what it is. If the district judge made an error of law, we correct it, we send it back. If the district judge abused his discretion, we correct it, we send it back. So it seems like, I'm trying to help you here, it seems like he made an error of law. We should send it back for a do-over on the question of extraordinary and compelling. Is that what you want or not?
That would be what Mr. Rice would would request, Your Honor.
Okay, so once you do that, then you got to go on to the 3553A factors, right?
Correct.
And I think you're saying that you want us to tell him that he can also consider what happened here in connection with evaluating the 3553A factors. Is that right?
That's correct.
So it comes up twice. Was it can it be extraordinary and compelling? And if so, how does it factor in fit 3553A, right?
That's correct. I don't believe that the illegal sentence as it stands has to be one or the other. I believe that once the district court determines that the sentence that exceeds 5 years beyond the statutory maximum that Congress set is extraordinary and compelling, then the court would go to the 3553A factors and determine what exactly would the sentence be, notwithstanding the fact that the prior sentence included a 15-year mandatory minimum. And that's basically the district court.
Well, see, now that's where I think we're off the rails again. You seem to be saying in the second factor that because of what was determined under extraordinary and compelling, therefore he has to get a new sentence under 3553A. And that isn't what I asked you. I asked you whether you simply take into account what the sentence was below and whether it's consistent with other sentences in evaluating the 3553A factors. The judge can still say, no, I think the other factors against him under 3350A outweigh the disparity in sentence. Am I saying that incorrectly?
I understand what you're saying, Your Honor, but I don't believe that the district court, if it finds that the 15-year mandatory minimum sentence imposed was an exceptional and compelling circumstance, I don't believe the 3553A factors would permit him to still impose a 15-year sentence based upon the fact that the statutory maximum for a 922G1 offense is 10 years. So at most, the district court could impose a 10-year sentence based upon the 3553A factors, but he is not within his province to sentence him any higher than that and still avoid the separation of powers issues as identified in Hill versus Masters.
Do you have any case that says once having found something is extraordinary and compelling, therefore that cabins what the district judge can do in evaluating 3553A?
I don't believe that there is a case that talks about that, Your Honor. There may be. I may not have found it. But in this unique circumstance, because the sentence that my client is currently serving is 5 years above the statutory maximum, if he finds that that sentence is a violation of the separation of powers based upon the fact that Mr. Rice no longer qualifies as an armed career criminal, then I believe that that's how the 3553A factors will then factor in establishing a new sentence. I don't believe this is the same case as those cases that talk about the First Step Act, because those cases are based upon congressional changes to statutes. And we're not talking about that, and we're not even speaking on retroactivity at this point, because Mr. Rice continuously challenged his sentence based upon those Ohio robberies.
Was the case of United States v. Yates already decided before the appeal became final, or in your case or not?
Yes. United States versus Yates was decided on August 9th of 2017. Mr. Rice's appeal was finalized. Well, the opinion was released in his appeal on May 19th of 2017. And it was the exact argument. It was the same statute as in Yates. And in that 90-day window that Mr. Rice could have filed a certiorari petition, which Clay versus United States says that 90 days, at the end of that 90-day petition period, starts the 2255 clock. So Mr. Rice was still within his province to challenge his sentence based upon Yates, even though his counsel failed to do so. In those challenges, Mr. Rice continuously made assertions to the district court that his sentence was not valid. However, in his 2255, he did not file the 2255 until more than a year past the Yates decision, which would took him outside of the statutory limitation period. Unfortunately, Mr. Rice was not informed, and Mr. Rice is challenged. He has many mental health issues, and he's a difficult client to communicate with, but he never gave up his rights to challenge his appeal. And if he had known that his appeal had been decided, he was never informed of that by his lawyer until late in 2018, which is when he penned his own 2255 to the district court. So that is why I am saying that Mr. Rice never invoked any retroactive anything, because Johnson had been decided a year prior to his...
Well, thank you, Ms. Malone. You can finish with your rebuttal time. Ms. Lutzko, you're appearing remotely. Can you hear us okay?
I can, Your Honor. Can you hear me as well?
Yes. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, Becky Lutzko on behalf of the United States. The district court here properly exercised its discretions in its two separate holdings that this court must consider, specifically in its determination that there were not extraordinary and compelling reasons to grant compassionate release, and further that the 3553A factors did not warrant release here. In response to one of the questions from the bench, I would note here that in its order, specifically at page ID 535, the district court did acknowledge that it could consider the post-appeal change in law here vis-a-vis the Yates decision and how that would affect Mr. Rice's sentence if sentenced today as part of the 3553A factors. Focusing on the extraordinary and compelling ruling, however, there were two components to that, both of which I think are worth discussing, and I will spend the primary time on whether the non-retroactive sentencing change that occurred via Yates can constitute an extraordinary and compelling condition. But I would contrast that initially with the medical component.
I believe you said that Yates cannot be retroactive. And what's the basis of why Yates is not retroactive?
Well, it is not self-effectuating. As your honors are well aware, Congress set up 2255 as the exclusive means for federal prisoners to collaterally attack a conviction or a sentence that's alleged to violate the Constitution or federal law. And so when this sentence, that's the fundamental defect in the defense argument here. This sentence, when imposed, was valid and was legal.
Was it really legal in light of Yates? I mean, Yates has said, basically established that Mansour was wrongly decided. So how can we say that it really was legally correct in light of what Yates now says?
So when it was imposed under this circuit's law, albeit unpublished in Mansour did hold that the three predicate convictions here constituted ACCA force clause predicates.
So right, but your problem is, though, excuse me, that Mansour is not a binding precedent because it was unpublished. And Yates, I thought, said that the Ohio robbery statute was never a crime of violence, right?
So, Your Honor, Yates certainly does say that Ohio robbery statute does not qualify. And we do engage in a legal fiction of saying that this was not the law as we go, because it was not a published decision. It was an unpublished decision. But this court repeatedly before Yates held in additional unpublished decisions that Manser was correct and that the Ohio robbery statute was a valid predicate. And so the larger point is when something like this happens and when this court reverses its course, albeit from an unpublished decision to a published decision, the proper course of action and what Congress has set up for a defendant to do is to file a 2255. Congress has also put significant limitations on what a defendant must do in order to take advantage of the post-conviction rules. And that is no different than the limitations that Congress put in place, as recognized in Jarvis, of making 924C not retroactive. It's just a different context, but nonetheless, Congress has set up those rules, and the defendant, in order to take advantage of Yates, had to file a 2255.
Ms. Lutzko, could I interrupt you, please?
I want to
go back to sort of your fundamental premise here, and that's that this was a legislative change that wasn't made retroactive, and because that's not what happened here. There was no change in legislative in the statute. So when I look at the language in the district judge order that you directed us to earlier, he says the compassionate release statute wasn't intended to address changes in the law which the legislature chose not to make retroactive. Now that's true, but that's not this case. And then he goes on to say the court recognizes that if there are other extraordinary and compelling reasons, so on and so forth. So he seemed to have been proceeding on the same assumption that you are, and that is that a change in interpretation of the law is the same as a specific statutory change the legislature deems non-retroactive. And I'm having trouble finding any limitation on using this particular circumstance as an extraordinary and compelling change. I'm not saying whether it should or shouldn't be, but it seems to me he had the discretion to make that determination. He didn't realize he had it, so therefore that's where the error occurs.
So, Your Honor, I certainly recognize, certainly you're correct that the court did focus on the legislative change and use that language. And I would not, however, characterize the government's argument as an assumption regarding a legislative change, in that it is our position that this sentence is still a legally valid sentence because Mr. Rice did not properly follow the Section 2255 relief that Congress provided to a defendant in this situation. And because Yates is essentially not self-effectuating, that's true in any case where this court, through a case, changes its prior position, whether it's an unpublished decision or whether it's a published decision, such as in the Burris situation where this court sitting on bond modified Anderson, which was the Ohio's felonious assault and aggravated assault statute. And in that same type of situation, when this court through a case change makes a change in its jurisprudence, then a defendant has needs to do something in order to take advantage of or gain the benefit of that. And that Congress has set up through the post-conviction procedures, and in particular 2255. And enforcing here, Mr. Rice filed that petition approximately 4 months late. And enforcing the statute of limitations in a 2255 proceeding, or procedural default rules, or the re-litigation bar, all those things that these members across the country do every day, is an ordinary practice. And so, and that is true whether the defendant has a substantive, valid, or meritorious claim or not. And therefore, it's the government's position that in this situation, even though today, if sentenced today, he would not qualify as an armed career criminal, his sentence is valid, and this is not an extraordinary circumstance.
Let me ask you this, counsel. This is a, 3582 motion, right, the compassionate release. All right, do you have any case that's directly on point that says that the defendant cannot use this 3582 motion to get relief here? What case can you cite us?
So the closest that I can cite to you is this court's opinions in Jarvis, Wills, and Holmes, as well as the Seventh Circuit's recent decision in Thacker, which do all involve First Step Act non-retroactive legislative changes. I have not found a case that involved the Armed Career Criminal Act and a change by a court on whether an interpretation of a state law predicate conviction.
All right, so this is, in some sense, then a matter of first impression here, isn't it?
Yeah, I would say sort of, except that I do think that Jarvis nonetheless controls, and the reasoning behind Jarvis is directly applicable here, because what this court is looking at is Congress's establishment of the 2255 proceedings as the way to address a claim that a sentence violates the Constitution or a sentence violates the law. And so,
Ms. Lutzko,
yes.
Ms. Lutzko, what I still don't understand is, I mean, I get Jarvis and Tomes. They say that a legislative change that's specifically deemed to be non-retroactive mm-hmm. can't be used to gain relief under the statute. I get that. But that's not our case here. We have a case where the law always was that this was not a predicate offense under Ohio law. We might have interpreted it in an unreported non-binding decision differently, but when the Supreme Court, when the Sixth Circuit publishes its opinion, ultimately, it takes us back to where the law always was. So I think what Ms. Malone is trying to say is that this guy never should have been sentenced with the mandatory minimum or the maximum, I've forgotten which it was, that he did. So where is the limitation in a case or a statute or anything else that prohibits these circumstances from being an extraordinary and compelling reason? What limits the district judge's discretion to determine whether it was or was not extraordinary and compelling?
Well, as your honors are well aware, the statutory criteria include four different considerations under 3582C that courts can modify a sentence, and otherwise you start with the default rule that a district court may not. Now, extraordinary and compelling is not defined in the statute, and there's of course a reference to the applicable sentencing commission policy statements, which this court has found does not bind a defendant when the defendant files the motion, or does not bind the court, when the defendant files the motion. However, this court has also recognized, I believe, in Tomes and in other situations, that guidance still is useful and provides guideposts to what constitutes extraordinary and compelling. And all of those reasons are things such as age, things such as terminal illness and significant medical risk, which are also what are reflected in the legislative history of the 3582 from the Sentencing Reform Act of 1984. It specifically references terminal illness such as terminal cancer, health problems, and involving particularly serious illnesses. And so I cannot cite to you a case that involves a specific situation. I guess the closest I could come, in addition to Jarvis, is there's a case in the Seventh Circuit recently, within the last few days, Berrios, that involved a claimed Elaine error, and where the Supreme Court then changed the position on whether a judge or the jury had to find that a mandatory minimum applied, and therefore the defendant claimed that Elaine error constituted an extraordinary compelling reason. So the Seventh Circuit rejected that and found that it could not, that was the same equivalent type of a change in sentencing law via a case that we have that situation here. And I will provide that citation here to Berrios. It is an unpublished case. It's 2021 Westlaw 3116052, Seventh Circuit, July 22nd of 2021. So that's the, I think, the most analogous thing I can cite. Your Honors, I know I'm running short on time, and I do want to focus on one other piece, which is related to this, which is the government's position that the medical components of the district court's opinion and the medical components of the claim raised by the defendant here are the proper focus for extraordinary and compelling reasons. And in particular, although the district court did not address these issues in the extraordinary and compelling analysis, I know that the defendant did raise his mental health issues as well as other issues as his claim for extraordinary and compelling reasons. Once counsel became involved, they focused on the sentencing issue. But it is the government's position that while the district court did not abuse its discretion here in rejecting at least the asthma condition and combination with COVID as constituting an extraordinary and compelling reason, that would have been a proper fodder for the district court, as well as the mental health conditions raised by the defendant, Mr. Rice, as proper fodder or proper consideration in the appropriate case to constitute extraordinary and compelling reasons.
But have you got any case that says that it has to be medical to be extraordinary and compelling? Is there anything that really limits it solely to medical?
The things that would limit it to medical would be legislative history, the cases that I've cited, certainly sentencing commission's policy statement, but those are not, of course, binding on the district.
Right. So basically, you have no case that you can cite as that limits it to medical.
Correct, Your Honor. The only thing that I can point to, that says is that challenging collaterally attacking a sentence claiming to violate the constitutional federal law is the exclusive province of a Section 2255 petition. And I would cite Davis versus United States, 417 U.S. 333 from 1974. The Supreme Court's decision there made it very clear that 2255 is the appropriate avenue to raise such a challenge such as this.
Thank you, Ms. Letzko. Ms. Malone, do you have a rebuttal?
Your Honors, if I may just very briefly thank the court for accommodating me to appear remotely. I appreciate it.
Very well.
Thank you. Judge Gilman, in Hill versus Masters, this court determined that 2241 was also an avenue that a defendant could use when they were faced with a sentence that was infirm, specifically constitutionally infirm. So there is other avenues other than 2255 that a defendant can use, and that which Congress is well aware of, that will satisfy the need to challenge a prior sentence. 2255 is not the sole province of for defendants to use to challenge their sentence. And indeed, in the legislative history of 3582, specifically in the Senate report 98-225, this committee says that those cases, talking about the compassionate release, those would include cases of severe illness, cases in which other and compelling circumstances justify a reduction of an unusually long sentence, and some cases in which the sentencing guidelines for the offense of which the defendant was convicted have been later amended to provide a shorter term of imprisonment. Now, that's the legislative history. So the legislative history when this statute was formed in 1984 specifically stated that not only physical illnesses or severe illnesses or impending death was the only means by which 3582 could be used to challenge a sentence. Congress contemplated this exact situation where there was no other avenue, and extraordinary and compelling circumstances could include an an unusually long sentence. And it could include a sentence that had been later amended by the guidelines. So those parameters for extraordinary and compelling were set forth in the legislative history of the statute. Therefore, the district courts throughout the country are free to find that exceptional and exceptional circumstances exist outside of health, outside of COVID-19, if they are egregious enough. And it is Mr. Rice's point that the 15-year sentence that has been imposed is an egregious sentence based upon the fact that he was misrepresented by counsel by failing to challenge to continue to represent him when faced with an appellate decision that was specifically against the decision that was decided for him less than 3 months before.
How long has he been in prison now?
He's been, well, that's a whole other issue, but he has been, he was evaluated for almost a year at FCI Butner before he was even sentenced. So in all, he's been locked up for close to 7 years. So
Ms. Malone, I was with your rebuttal argument right up until the very end, where now it seems like when you get into ineffective assistance of counsel, you're getting perilously close to sounding like this should be over into 2241 or 2255 or 54, whichever it is. So I thought your argument was this is extraordinary and compelling simply because it was imposed based upon a misunderstanding of what the law said. Now you're saying that what is the district judge supposed to throw in an IAC claim as well here in determining that this particular sentence was extraordinary and compelling?
No. The district court did not have to consider whether or not former counsel was ineffective. That statement was made, and the argument is that the situation that Mr. Rice is in with serving a 15-year sentence is extraordinary and compelling based upon the history of his case and what happened.
Upon the reliance upon Mansour, which was unpublished and wrong.
That's correct.
So you stop right there, don't you, basically?
Well, yes, you would stop right there if in fact there was not further history of this case. And the fact that Mr. Rice did challenge his case on 2255, albeit untimely. So that's why I included that. And Mr. Rice, in his 3582 initial pro se opinion, also included some mention of ineffective assistance. And I see I'm out of time.
Thank you, counsel. We will take the case under submission.